Going to discuss today is some of the very basic, very simple halachos that we need to know for the night of the Seder and for Erev Pesach. I don't think there will be anything that is a major chiddush to anybody, but it's always good to review that which many of us think that we know, just to make sure that we know it properly. As we know, the Gemara tells us, Shloshim Yom Kodem Achag, when it comes 30 days before any Yom Tif, the Gemara says we have an obligation to begin to study and to familiarize ourselves with the laws of that particular Yom Tov. And certainly when it comes to the holiday of Pesach, we have that obligation more so than on other Yom Tovim, because when it comes to Pesach, there are so many halachos that we need to be aware of. So we have the Kashering class tomorrow, and we have all of the halachos that we need to know about how to get ourselves ready, and Bedikas Chametz, and what if we're going away. You are not putter from Bedikas Chametz just because you're leaving your house for Pesach. You have to make sure you know the halachos well. So there's much for everybody to be aware of. What I'd like to focus on today is the halachos that govern the night of the Seder as well as Erev Pesach. And we begin with the following. If you look in the Chumash itself, the Chumash tells us that we have three items that we need to eat, that we need to consume on the night of the Seder. Those three items are Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. What is the reason why we have to eat Pesach, Matzah, and Maror? Well, number one, we have to shecht the Karban Pesach every year when we have a Beis HaMikdash on Erev Pesach, in order to remind us of the great miracle of Makas Bechoros. How does the Karban Pesach remind us of the miracle of Makas Bechoros? Well, as we know, in the times of the great miracle of Makas Bechoros, everybody was supposed to shecht the Karban Pesach and sprinkle the blood on top of the doorpost. And so to speak, that was the way that God knew how to be poseach, how to skip over, as if God needed a reminder, not exactly sure why he needed that. But we're told in the Psukim that that is what every Jew had to do, was to put the blood on top of the doorpost. And that is the way their firstborns were saved from the tragedy that took place in Mitzrayim on that occasion. So that is the reason why we have a Karban Pesach when celebrating, when commemorating the holiday of Pesach. We then move to the second item which the Torah tells us, which is the matzah. Why do we have the obligation to have matzah? So the Torah says it's to remind us of the fact that the Jewish people went out b'chipazon, they went out in a haste, they went out very quickly, and therefore they did not have a chance for the dough to rise, and all they were able to eat was matzah. And finally, we have an obligation that the Torah outlines for us, which is that we have to eat maror as well. And maror, obviously, is supposed to remind us of the terrible oppression, of the bondage, of the slavery that took place throughout our years as a nation in Mitzrayim. Today, unfortunately, we do not have a Beis HaMikdash, and therefore we do not offer a Karban Pesach. Yes, every year you hear that there's a small group of Jews that goes up and offers a Karban Pesach. That is obviously not the common practice. It is outside of the scope of today's discussion, whether or not it's proper, but it seems pretty clear to all of us that that is not the general practice all over the world. We do not have an opportunity to offer a Karban Pesach today. That being said, it means that the centerpiece, the highlight of the Seder, is missing. The Karban Pesach used to be what the entire Seder revolved around. And as a replacement for that, we now have the institution of Afikoman. Right? So at the very end of the Seder, we were supposed to be eating the Karban Pesach. It's very strange that that used to be the dessert. It's very unusual that the dessert used to be the main course, but that is what it had to be. So much so that we know you're not allowed to eat anything after you eat the Karban Pesach. That is what is supposed to linger in your mouth after the Seder is over. The taste of the Karban Pesach is supposed to remain. And that has been what governs our practice today as well. After one consumes the Afikoman, sometimes you want to wash it down so you can take water, certainly. There's no problem. There's no objection to that. But to have a coffee or other things, or to have soda, something of that nature, one is really supposed to be careful not to do that after consuming the Afikoman, because Afikoman takes the place of the Karban Pesach, and the Karban Pesach really was meant to be the last thing that was in our taste buds as we finished off the night of the Seder. So that is with regard to the Karban Pesach. Obviously, we do not have that. I would have said that when it comes to the matzah and the maror, our obligation should remain the same as it was. So when it comes to the matzah, that is true. Our obligation to eat matzah today is on the same level as it was in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. Because the Pasuk says, Ba'erev tochlu matzos, on the night of the Seder you have to eat matzah, which applies equally in the times of a Beis HaMikdash as well as in the times when you do not have a Beis HaMikdash. It applies whether you have a Karban Pesach or you don't have a Karban Pesach. We have the biblical obligation to consume matzah on the night of the Seder, because the Pasuk says, Ba'erev tochlu matzos. However, when it comes to eating the maror, here we find something very unusual. There, when we're instructed to eat the mar, we are told, Al matzos umarorim yochluhu. You're supposed to eat the Karban Pesach in a sandwich, together with the maror and together with the matzah. And therefore, the Gemara assumes that because we do not have the Karban Pesach today, therefore the obligation of maror today is not on the biblical level that it once was either, because the Torah outlines the mitzvah of maror that it's supposed to be done as a cooperation between the Karban Pesach and the maror. Both of those are supposed to be eaten together, and because we do not have a Karban Pesach today, therefore we don't really have the biblical obligation of maror either. So midrabanan, they instituted that we're supposed to eat maror today regardless, but that is not the same obligation that we once had in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. The final mitzvah that we have of consumption on the night of the Seder is that the Chachamim instituted that we are supposed to drink 4 cups of wine on the night of the Seder, and that is a way in which we are supposed to express our gratitude, our sense of excitement, and our elation over the fact that we no longer are considered slaves in Egypt, and now we are considered to be free people. And there's no greater way to express that than over a cup of wine, the same way we make a l'chaim whenever we have some sort of joyous occasion. So that's what we do on the night of the Seder as well. It's like we have 4 cups of wine to make a l'chaim with each other to show how excited we are, how grateful we are over the fact that we are no longer under the bondage, under the enslavement of Mitzrayim. So now let's discuss some of these items, and let's try to just explain very simply what it is that we're doing. The first thing that we encounter when they come to the Seder is the Ka'ara. Now, it's interesting, if you look in the Gemara, you will not find that they had a practice of having a Ka'ara. This is something that happened later on in history, which is surprising, because for us, it's the centerpiece of the table, but that is not what it was in the times of the Gemara. So what exactly are we supposed to put on this Ka'ara? What should be placed? Which items do we need in order to have the Ka'ara set up properly? Primarily, we need to have, obviously, the Maror, because Maror we're going to have to use later on in the evening, and therefore we want it to be readily available for everybody, so we have Maror that we place onto the Ka'ara. To that end, we also put Charoses, because as you know, the Maror has to be dipped in the Charoses, so therefore we're supposed to put Maror and Charoses on the Ka'ara, so then when we need it later on, we will know exactly where it is. How are we supposed to make the Charoses? That is a good question. Everybody has delicious, wonderful recipes, but one thing that we're supposed to keep in mind on top of all the recipes is that there's supposed to be some sort of wine in the Charoses as well. And that is in order to remind us there are many things we do on the night of the Seder which are symbolic. So on the night of the Seder, we're supposed to have wine in the Charoses in order to remind us, number one, of the blood of the Jewish children that were killed in the experience in Mitzrayim, which is a very great tragedy, but also the Charoses is supposed to be a thick kind of consistency in order to remind us of the cement that they used to use, the cement in the times of the enslavement as well. They would make the Jews work hard on the cement, and that is something that we're supposed to think about as we have the Charoses and as we dip the maror into the Charoses as well. It might surprise some of you that the Rambam is of the opinion that not only is there a mitzvah to eat matzah and to eat maror and to eat Karban Pesach, and we have a mitzvah to eat, to drink the 4 cups of wine, but the Rambam says we also have a mitzvah to eat charoses on the night of the Seder. So much so that the Rambam writes in the Pirush HaMishnayis that in his opinion one should even make a bracha al achilas charoses, which is something that I assume none of us have ever seen in a Haggadah, but it's a fascinating insight that the Rambam has. So my father always pointed out by our Seder as children that obviously we do not follow, we do not accept the opinion of the Rambam. But why not? If we have the opportunity, and many people like charoses anyway, so we may as well satisfy the opinion of the Rambam. What do you have to lose by eating in the middle of the meal at some point to just take a spoonful of charoses and eat a little bit of it, a kazayis? Why not? You may as well fulfill the opinion of the Rambam. If he believes it's really a mitzvah that's supposed to be done on the night of the Seder, we may as well try and do that as well. Obviously, if you don't like charoses, so it's not something that you should do. But if it's something you like to do anyway, you may as well have in mind that you're fulfilling the opinion of the Rambam as well. The next item on the Ka'ara that we place is the karpas, because as we know, we have karpas in the very beginning of the Seder. And the only reason why we have karpas in the beginning of the Seder is kedei sheyishalu hatinokos. We do something very unusual, we do something strange, which is very much the theme of the night of the Seder. We do different activities in order to arouse our children, in order to keep them engaged, in order to keep them excited, and karpas is the very first thing that we do, which is meant to engage the children, meant to have them ask questions why it is that we're doing that. After that, we know that we put on the Seder 2 roasted items. I don't know what the practice is in everybody's home, but we are supposed to put an egg. That, I think, is universal. And then there's a little question about what the other item is supposed to be. The way the Achronim say it is, it's supposed to be a zeroa. A zeroa is a wing, I think, wing of a chicken, right? But many people have the practice to put a shank bone. I don't know, many different practices. All of them are wonderful. All of them are great. The reason why it's supposed to be a zeroa and a beitza is for the following. In the times of the Beis HaMikdash, as we mentioned, they used to have the centerpiece of the Seder was the Korban Pesach. So that, unfortunately, we do not have today, and therefore we put a zeroa in its place. We put a piece of meat, a piece of chicken, in the place of the Korban Pesach, and we roast it the same way the Korban Pesach was roasted as well. And this is what we do. Why do we choose to put a zeroa? So the Acharonim say, because we know, on the occasion of Yitzias Mitzrayim, it says, B'yad chazaka uv'zroa netuya, that God took us out with an outstretched arm, and that is the reason why the practice has developed, that we put a zeroa in the place of the Korban Pesach. One should not make a mistake and say, this is an actual Korban Pesach. When we try to explain to our children or grandchildren what is on the Ka'ara, we should not say, this is the Korban Pesach. We should explain to them that this is in the place of the Korban Pesach, simply to remind us that the Seder this year is incomplete. The Seder this year is not the way it's supposed to be. We are missing what is the very fabric of the Seder itself. We are missing the most important element of the Seder, which is the Korban Pesach. But secondly, we have to put an egg on the Ka'ara. What is an egg all about? So the answer is, in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, not only did they have to offer a Korban Pesach, but every Yom Tov, when the Jews came to Yerushalayim, when the Jews ascended the Beis HaMikdash and used to offer Karbanos in honor of the Yom Tov, one of the things that had to be offered was a Karban Chagiga. So on top of whatever else they were bringing, they had to bring something that they referred to as a Karban Chagiga, a way of celebrating the Yom Tov with their families. They would bring a Karban and then everybody would eat it. So when it came to the Pesach celebration, that was the very same. Not only did they used to offer a Karban Pesach per se, but they would also offer a Karban Chagiga. And as a replacement for the Karban Chagiga, we put an egg on the Ka'ara as well. Why do we choose to have an egg? A Karban doesn't lay eggs, right? When you bring an animal to the Beis HaMikdash, you don't have eggs coming out of it. So why do we assume that the Karban Chagiga's substitute should now be an egg? The answer to that is because, if unfortunately anybody in the room has ever been in Avelos, we know that when the Avel comes back from the cemetery, the first thing that we offer them is a meal that is made from round items. We serve bagels, we serve eggs, we serve a number of items that are round. Why is that? Because round reminds us of the circle of life. That unfortunately we have many, many things that disappoint us in life and many tragedies throughout our lives, but we also have the opportunity that me'ashpos yarem evyon, life will continue to go around. It's a galgal achozer be'olam. And sometimes people are down, and at other points in their lives, people are going to be up. At some points in people's lives, they're going to be rich. At other points in people's lives, they're going to be poor. This is the gagal achozer ba'olam. This is the way, unfortunately, our world runs. We don't always have a consistent life the way we might want it to be, and therefore we serve avelim round items in order that they should be reminded of the fact that life is going to go in a circle, and things perhaps will come back around. And this is what we try to do on the night of the Seder as well. We remind ourselves that we are in some sort of state of avelus. As excited as we are to celebrate Pesach, and as wonderful as it is to be around the table with our families and our children and grandchildren and whoever else might be there, we also have to be reminded that we are missing something that is so central to what the Pesach Seder is all about. We do not have a Beis HaMikdash. We do not have a Karban Pesach. We do not have a Karban Chagiga. And to highlight the fact that we are missing and we are in a state of avelus, we also want to make the fact that we also want to make the mention of the round items, the same way we would do for anyone else who would be in Avelus throughout the year. We do that on the night of the Seder as well. So that is the basic structure of the Ka'ara. That is why we have all the items that we do. The Mishnah tells us, if you look in the first entry on the source sheet, the Mishnah tells us that on Erev Pesach, one has to be careful that they develop an appetite, that they build up a desire for the mitzvahs that they have to do on the night of the Seder. And therefore the Mishnah says, it is going to be a full stomach when we come to the Seder and we have to eat matzah and we have to eat maror and we're also supposed to eat a meal on the night of the Seder, and then we have to leave room for afikoman at the end of the Seder as well, which sometimes is difficult for people. Well, says the Mishnah, you should go out of your way on Erev Pesach to make sure that you calculate properly, to make sure that you do it the right way. How is one supposed to do that? Well, says the Mishnah, Arvei Pesachim, Samach Lemincha, when it comes to Erev Pesach, So around mincha time, one should already make sure lo yochal adam ad shetechshach. One should make sure that they don't eat too much food on Erev Pesach in the afternoon, because if you do so, you will not have enough room to eat what you have to eat on the night of the Seder. Now, when you think about this carefully, there aren't so many items that you even have the ability to eat on Erev Pesach. Because after 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, you're not allowed to eat chametz anymore, and anything that's left in your house you have sold to the non-Jew. And you're really, says the Mishnah, you're not allowed to eat matzah on Erev Pesach, because we want that everybody should be excited about eating matzah on Erev Pesach, on Pesach night itself. So if you're already going to eat it on Erev Pesach, you're not going to have any enjoyment on Pesach itself. There are some who have the practice that they refrain from eating matzah the entire duration of the month before Pesach, or 2 weeks before Pesach. I think my family does not have that practice, but many people do. It is not mentioned in the Gemara itself, but it is a practice that's also for the same reason, that if you're going to have such a routine of eating matzah throughout the month before Pesach, perhaps when it comes Pesach itself, you're not going to be so excited, you won't really want to eat the matzah, and this is something the Gemara says we should go out of our way to try to do as well, that we should have an appetite when it comes to the night of the Seder, and we should not be full when the night of the Seder comes in. That being said, we don't have to starve. So Erev Pesach comes around, it doesn't mean we should have nothing for our children or ourselves to eat. We are certainly allowed to eat peiros, we're allowed to eat fruits, we're allowed to eat vegetables, we're allowed to eat things that are not considered a full meal. We should try our best to leave room, but certainly we do not have to starve, and certainly because at this time of year when we just change the clocks, we're not going to get around to eating on the night of the Seder till pretty late. When one is trying to budget the time for the Seder, I remember as a child every year after Pesach we would all come to school and the Rabbein would ask us, you know, what time did you finish your Seder, you know, the first night, right? They still do that? I don't know. So I was so embarrassed because everyone in the class would always raise their hands, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. My father was the only one who actually followed what the halacha is, and that is you're supposed to finish the Seder by chatzos. So my father always used to rush it and make sure that everybody was finished and save all of your gematrias for tomorrow. We're going to talk about them tomorrow during the meal. So I always would, you know, sit in the back of class and raise my hand and say, you know, we were done at 11:30. And the Rabbein always used to look at me, you know, what kind of house do you come from? So unfortunately, I come from the wonderful house that I do. And my father always made sure that we finished all 4 cups of wine by chatzos, which is really what one is supposed to do. So it's very nice to have a late Seder and to engage our children, but there's a limit to how much you can engage them. There's a limit to how much you're able to do it. And the Shulchan Aruch really says you're supposed to try to eat the afikoman, and with all the Divrei Torah and with everything we want to say, and it's all beautiful and wonderful, but we're really supposed to certainly finish the afikoman by chatzos, and lechatchila the Shulchan Aruch says you're really supposed to finish all 4 cups of wine with Hallel by Chatzos as well. So you can sing the rest of the night, Nirtza and everything else, it's wonderful, but the 4 cups of wine with the Afikoman are really supposed to be drank before Chatzos Halayla. Every year it fluctuates, but you have to find out what time that is, and when budgeting the time for the Seder, you have to keep that in mind as well, which means when you get to the main course, it's going to be 10 o'clock at night, 10:30 at night. So one should think about that, that once the Seder night comes in, you're not really going to eat until later, so you certainly should have something to eat in the afternoon, that you're not starving, but the Gemara says we should have only things that are not going to completely fill us up in order to leave room for the night of the Seder. Another detail that is mentioned in this Mishnah that we just read is lo yochal adam ad shetechshach. One is not allowed to eat until it gets dark outside, which is a very curious statement, because every Shabbos and every Yom Tov we know that we have this idea of Tosefes. Many of us prefer to make early Shabbos because who wants to make Shabbos at 8 o'clock at night? Our children want to eat, our children want to go to sleep on time, and we don't want to make Shabbos so late. It's much more convenient for all of us to make Shabbos in the summertime at 6:30 or 6 o'clock, and that is something that we certainly are allowed to do. Not only are we allowed to make early Shabbos, but the Gemara says you're allowed to make Kiddush before it's dark outside, and you're allowed to eat the bread before it's dark outside. Some even say you might be allowed to bench. Maybe, perhaps, you're allowed to finish the whole meal before it's even dark outside. That's questionable, but this is what we generally do on a regular Shabbos throughout the year. So it's curious, when you come to the night of the Seder, why the Mishnah says that lo yochal adam ad shetechshach, I'm not allowed to eat until it gets dark outside. What is that all about? And the answer that the Balei HaTosa suggests is because the Pasuk says, va'achlu es habasar balayla hazeh. The Pasuk says you have to eat the Karban Pesach at night, which means that you're not allowed to start the mitzvahs of the evening until it turns nightfall, until it's dark outside. And therefore, we have this exception to the rule by Pesach that we have to wait until it's night, even though by a regular Shabbos, we would be able to start earlier. Now, that includes the first cup of wine as well. You're not allowed to start the Seder with the first cup of wine before it's dark outside. You have to wait for everything to be done until it's dark. Every year, I remember when I was learning with my father for the many, many years that I was able to do so. So every year before Pesach, I remember the same question used to come in. You know, my father's phone is ringing off the hook for weeks before Pesach. Many people have different issues that they need to discuss with him. And one thing that he always told us was that if Pesach is man cheruseinu, if Pesach is the time where we're supposed to be free, he said that it bothers him that so many doctors who are ER doctors or Hatzalah members tell him that people have to be rushed to the hospital on the night of the Seder because they drank wine that they weren't allowed to drink, or they drank marah that they weren't allowed to eat, or they consumed too much matzah that they weren't allowed to eat either. So my father always says that one has to keep in mind when performing all of the mitzvahs halayla, you have to also be mindful of the fact that it is man cheruseinu. And if it's going to make you feel unwell to a point that you're going to have to be hospitalized, you certainly have to think about that in advance. My father always tells us that Rabbi Schwab, who was the rabbi of Breuers, very prominent Talmud Chacham, had an issue at the end of his life that he wasn't allowed to have gluten, I think, or he wasn't allowed to have bread. So every Shabbos, at the end of his life, he told my father that he was not able to wash on bread any longer because the doctors told him it was unhealthy for him. But he said on the night of the Seder, when he had a mitzvah, midaraisa, to eat matzah, so he said he used to take one small kezias of matzah on the first night of the Seder, and he said the second night of the Seder, which is only midirabanan and chutz la'aretz, he would take an even smaller amount. So he said, this is the great Rabbi Schwab, he used to go out of his way all year, he never ate bread, but on the night of the Seder, he took a very small amount, which the doctors allowed him to have. But we all have to be mindful of the fact, it is man cheruseinu, and therefore we should feel a sense of enjoyment, a sense of pleasure, and if it's going to be too difficult for a person, you have to think in advance, which parts are you going to leave out, and which parts perhaps are you going to take a smaller amount in order not to make yourself sick from all the mitzvahs that you have to observe on the night of the Seder. That is number one. Point number two that he always was asked every year, and I'm sure he's still being asked, it is, we had many nursing homes and hospitals that used to call our home before Pesach and ask my father, what are we supposed to do? We have many elderly patients who are not able to stay up till 10, 11 o'clock at night. We want to give them a Pesach experience. We want to have a Seder, but we can't keep them up so late. So what are we supposed to do? And my father was always faced with this issue because you cannot start the Seder before nightfall. So again, it depends what you're dealing with. If you're dealing with a group of people who really, let's say, have dementia, and you just want to make them feel an experience of Pesach, but really they're not going to fully understand what it is that they're doing, so they're probably not really obligated to perform the mitzvahs of Pesach night anyway. So if that's the population that you're dealing with, certainly you can have the Seder in the afternoon, you can do anything to make them feel the Pesach experience because they probably do not have an obligation regardless. But if you're dealing just with a situation where people are old and they simply have an obligation to observe the mitzvahs halayla, but they're not able to do it in the way they normally used to, so you have to think about which parts of the Haggadah are you going to take out in this year, which parts are you going to abridge. My father always advised them. Obviously, the Echad Miyodea and all the songs of Nirtza, you can start the Seder with that. Right? So you can do that before it gets dark outside. But the Kiddush and everything else, you're supposed to really make sure to do that after nightfall. And my father used to go through the Haggadah with them and point out which parts of the Haggadah are more essential and which parts you're allowed to leave out. Because the Haggadah was a collaboration of many, many years of work. And therefore, there are certain parts of the Haggadah that are much more critical for us to say, and certain parts of the Haggadah that when you have extenuating circumstances, you can leave it out. I remember one year, there was somebody whose wife was in labor on the night of the Seder. Can't remember if it happened when I was here in Woodmere, or perhaps when I was still in my parents' house. I don't remember exactly when this happened, but there was a woman who was in labor on the night of the Seder, and she felt healthy enough, she said, she felt she could sit around at the table, and she was not imminently going to the hospital, but she felt over the course of the evening she would have to go to the hospital, which is wonderful and it's great. And I remember the husband came over to the house to ask, what are we supposed to do? So I remember my father told him, look, you know, the most important thing is obviously that your wife should be healthy and you should get to the hospital in time. But if you have the opportunity to do so, you should try and abridge the Seder as much as you can and do everything in the proper order. So the guy responded and he said, so why don't we just drink 4 cups of wine and grape juice now, and then we'll have the matzah and we'll do everything, and whatever we can say later in the hospital, we'll say. So that doesn't work. The Gemara says we have an obligation to drink 4 cups of wine on the night of the Seder, but shason bevas achas, if you drink all of them in one shot, so that doesn't work. Because there's no meaning to that. You're supposed to drink 4 cups of wine, and each one is supposed to be representative of a different part of the Seder. And therefore we assume it is better to try and abridge the Seder, to do things in order, but to do it a little bit more quickly and leave out all the gematrias perhaps, and then do all the mitzvahs in the proper order that they're supposed to be done. But obviously, if one needs to go to the hospital, they should do whatever is necessary. They should make sure they are healthy. A detail that the Shulchan Aruch mentions here, and it's something to think about. I remember as a child, we all used to come home from shul, and everybody used to start fighting about where they're going to sit, and who's sitting next to this one, and who's going to sit next to that one, and you annoy me during the Seder. You know, we were children like everybody else was. So my father used to get upset, and he said that the Shulchan Aruch writes the following. If you look in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Taf Ayin Beis, this is number Gimel here, it says that, I'm sorry, if you look in the second entry here, we're told, Yihyeh Shulchano Aruch Miba Od Yom. One should make sure, number one, that the table is set up before you get to the table. I remember at home, my mother loves Pesach. She always used to set the table, like, I don't know, a few days before Pesach. So it always bothered us as children, because where are we going to eat now? And it was just annoying. But it was a beautiful thing. And we knew that Pesach was coming, and it was something that everybody was able to see. And the Shulchan Aruch says, your table should be set before you come home from shul. Why is that? The Aruch HaShulchan explains very simply. He says, you've ever been to an elegant meal, you've ever been to a classy restaurant, they don't start setting the table once you get there. When you get to a very fancy meal, it is all set. When you come to a fancy wedding, everything is set beforehand, and all the place cards are in place before you get there. And you don't start fighting where you're going to sit, and who's going to sit next to who. It's all figured out in advance before we get there. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch says, that is part of our feeling, like a majestic feeling on the night of the Seder. We should make sure that everything is set up in advance, that when we come home from shul, we're not scrambling to try to find our seats and to try to figure out who's sitting where and to set the table. Everything should be there in advance, and we should make sure to start immediately, because our children are already exhausted. It's already late. We cannot start the Seder before it's dark outside, so we're already back on time. So this is something that we have to keep in mind, and we should try to do whatever we can to start immediately when we come home. I remember my father always used to get annoyed that, yes, the table was all set, but we all used to go, you know, everybody has their pillows that they like at the Seder, and everybody has the chairs that they prefer at the Seder, so it would take 10-15 minutes until everybody was shuffling around and doing whatever had to be done, and getting the pillows from the bedroom and putting them in the pillowcases. So my father always said, what were you doing all afternoon? Why couldn't somebody think about this in the afternoon? If you had a chair that you wanted, you should have brought it to the table earlier. But this is something that we should try and keep in mind as well. The Shulchan Aruch says also, if you look at number Gimel, that Yisader Shulchan, I'm happy to see that everybody shares the same experiences that I did. Okay, Yisader Shulchanu Yafe Bekelim Noem Kifi Kocho, says the Shulchan Aruch, on the night of the Seder, we should also try to set up the table with beautiful, with elaborate kinds of items on the table. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, we should try our best to put beautiful items out on the table on the night of the Seder. Writes the Maharil, who is the father of all Ashkenazic Jewry, the Maharil writes the following in number Dalit. Even though he says that Kol Yemos Hashana, all the other regular days of the year, Tov Limnoa Kelim Noim, on a regular day of the year, it is true that you should abstain from putting out such fancy items. That is not the way Jews live. Jews understand that although we have the right and we have the ability, sometimes we are blessed to live a life of plenty and to live a beautiful life, but we always have to remind ourselves, Nala es Yerushalayim, this is not where we belong. And as beautiful as our homes might be, they should not be as beautiful as they are ultimately able to be. We should always leave something back. We should leave something out from the beautiful festivities that we have to remind us of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Says the Maharil, although that is true that we should try and hold back a little bit throughout the course of the year in order to remind us of Zecha LeChurban, he says, Levad mi Leilos HaSeder, when it comes to the night of the Seder, we do not hold back. When it comes to the night of the Seder, we bring all of the silver onto the table, we make our tables very elegant, very majestic, very beautiful, in order that we should remind ourselves of the feeling of Derech Cheres. The Rambam says that every year when a person goes through the experience of the Seder, we should feel Ki'ilu Yatza Ata Mitzrayim. We should get the sense as if we are leaving Mitzrayim now. That's a very difficult thing for us to do. My father always told us as children That is probably the most difficult mitzvah that one can do on the night of the Seder. How am I supposed to envision myself as if I'm really having this sensational feeling of getting out of Mitzrayim? We don't even have an appreciation for what it is to be slaves. We don't have any understanding of what it means to live under a ruler, to be oppressed like that. So yes, it's true. We might have the gift of having Holocaust survivors at our table who can share with us what the experience is to be under a sense of rulership, under a dictatorship, under slavery, being oppressed. But for most of us growing up in the generation that we are, we don't even have the appreciation. We don't even have the understanding of what that means. So it's a very difficult mitzvah to do. But at the same time, the Shulchan Aruch says we should do whatever we can to try to engender a sense of freedom, a sense of chayrus, a sense of celebratory mode on the occasion of the Seder. Now, every Shabbos and Yom Tov, we have an obligation of both Kavod Shabbos and Oneg Shabbos. What is the difference? What is the distinction between Kavod Shabbos and Oneg Shabbos? That is not so clear, but the Vilna Gaon writes in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch that the difference is as follows. Anything that I do in anticipation for Shabbos, anything that I do before Shabbos starts, is under the category of Kavod Shabbos. Any enjoyment that I have throughout the course of Shabbos itself goes under the category of Oneg Shabbos. So say, for example, I take a shower before Shabbos. That is considered to be a part of Kavod Shabbos. I do my makeup, I do my hair, I clean the house, I do all kinds of things, I set the table. That is all a part of Kavod Shabbos. However, when I sit and I enjoy the food that I'm eating on Shabbos itself, or anything of that nature, that is referred to as Oneg Shabbos. So now we're going to have a trick. What about when I light the Shabbos candles? Which one is that? Both. Because on the one hand, I do it before Shabbos starts in anticipation of Shabbos. So that is a way of expressing my sense of Kavod Shabbos. On the other hand, I enjoy the candles themselves on Shabbos. And therefore we assume that that's also an expression of Oneg Shabbos. And therefore we assume the same way there's a obligation of Kavod and Oneg Shabbos when it comes to every regular Shabbos, those two obligations apply as well equally to a Yom Tov. We have Kavod Yom Tov and Oneg Yom Tov. You're supposed to do things to prepare yourself for Yom Tov properly, and you're supposed to enjoy the Yom Tov itself as well. Which means that the same way we light candles in anticipation for Shabbos, we should also light candles in anticipation for Yom Tov. So the Drisha, who's one of the commentators on the tour, writes that his great mother pointed out that there was a major mistake that women in her community made. That on Yom Tov, they felt that since you're allowed to light a fire on Yom Tov, so therefore, they used to light the candles on Yom Tov night when everybody came home from shul. And she said it was a big mistake. Because the same way you have an obligation to light the candles in anticipation for Shabbos before Shabbos begins, you should also light the candles in anticipation for Yom Tov before Yom Tov begins as well. Is there anyone in the room who has the practice to light the candles Yom Tov night after everybody comes home from shul? Nobody has that practice? Nobody heard of it? Even the first night of Yom Tov? There are some who have that practice, and the question is, where did it come from? What is that all about? Doesn't it make a lot of sense that we should light the candles, what? So in Europe, there were many communities who did that they used to light the candles on Yom Tov after everybody came home from shul, and the question is, why does that make sense? Where does it come from? So the Chasam Sofer explains, this minhag developed because there are times in which you have Shabbos that goes straight into Yom Tov. And obviously, when you have Shabbos that goes into Yom Tov, you're not allowed to light the candles until Shabbos is over. So in order not to make a mistake on those years, so we wanted it to be uniform. That every time when you have Yom Tov, everybody lights the candles after Yom Tov starts. And this way, you will not make a mistake when you have Shabbos going into Yom Tov, which certainly you're not allowed to light candles on any Shabbos, even if it's for the purposes of Kavod Yom Tov. So the Chasam Sofer writes, that's where the minute came from. That's where it developed, but it's very questionable whether or not it's the proper thing to do. Somebody mentioned at our shir last night about the Shehecheyanu, which is an interesting issue. When do women make Shehecheyanu is a great question. I know my father has told me in the past that when he got married, one of the stipulations he made with my mother was that she's not going to make Shehecheyanu when she lights candles on Yom Tov, she's going to wait for the Kiddush. I don't know. When I got married, I was thinking about other things. I guess this is on my father's mind. So that's a major discussion, whether or not it's proper for the woman to make the Shehecheyanu when she lights the candles, or should she wait off for the Shehecheyanu until Kiddush, when everyone else is going to make the Shehecheyanu? A big question, I think, the minhag all over the world is that women make Shehecheyanu when they light the candles, and then Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, well, if you have that practice, which I think most of the world does, So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, well, then what are you going to do when it comes to Kiddush? So you have somebody's making Kiddush, and in the context of Kiddush, they say Shechiyanu, and now you're going to answer Amen, which is a hefsek, because he didn't have to say Shechiyanu. And now you're going to want to drink the wine, but you made an interruption in between your Bari Priya Gavan and drinking the wine. Okay, all kinds of issues. But basically, I think the practice in most communities is you make Shechiyanu when you light the candles, and then you answer Amen also during the Kiddush when the Kiddush is going to be made. The Shulchan Aruch mentions what? Yeah, same with every yomtiv. Same goes with every yomtiv.
So could you just not answer Amen to that?
Certainly, that's the best. But again, you don't want to confuse people. I am always a fan of not confusing people. I think it's important that we have a religion where people know what they're supposed to be doing. So very often, people are going to start getting confused. If you don't answer Amen to that, maybe someone's going to leave out the Amen to the Bar Priya Gavan, which is more important. So I don't know. Yeah. So then you shouldn't make it.
Then you shouldn't make it.
If you have in mind that you don't want to be Yotze until your spouse makes Kiddush, well then, you shouldn't really make it earlier. That's a bracha levatala.
I thought there was a sheep that allows you to do that. No?
I don't know everything. It's possible. I don't know. Certainly possible. We all know the Shulchan Aruch writes that the man of the home, or the men of the home, are supposed to wear a kittel on the night of the Seder. It is not entirely clear what that's all about. It is a minhag, but where does it come from? Why do we do it? So the Magen Avraham presents two reasons, and he's not exactly sure why we do it. Number one, he says, maybe it's because the same way when we go to a fancy wedding, we put on a tuxedo, we put on something that's a fancier outfit, something nicer than we would normally wear. So too, when we come to the night of the Seder, where we're supposed to feel like kings and queens, so we're supposed to wear something that is more elegant, something that is special, something that is unique. So this is like our tuxedo. This is like the fancier garment, and that's why we have developed the practice that the men wear a kittel. I would venture to say that the kittels that most of us have seen are a piece of nothing, right? And it is cheaper than any suit or any other outfit that we would generally wear on a regular Shabbos or Yom Tov. So it's hard for me to imagine that that is really the origin of the practice. The Magen Avraham says perhaps another reason is because, and this is a more depressing, a more somber reason, says the Magen Avraham, you know, we're going to sit around on the night of the Seder with all the gold and silver on the table, and we're supposed to be leaning like kings and queens, and we're supposed to be enjoying everything, and we're supposed to be drinking wine. He says, let's not get too high on ourselves. Let's not forget about the fact that we are still human beings, and that life is not just one big joke and one big exciting party. And therefore, he writes, we should remind ourselves of Big Day Mesim. And because people are buried in a kittel, so therefore he writes, this is the reason why a kittel should be worn on the night of the Seder, in order that we should be reminded that life is serious, and life is not all about partying, and although the night of the Seder is very exciting, this is something that we have to make sure to remind ourselves of as well. That is what the Magen Avraham writes. And therefore, says the Magen Avraham, if that would be the reason, he says, let's say you have, God forbid, somebody who lost a relative within the past year. So he says, they don't need the reminder that life is serious. They know that life is not a joke. They know that life is serious. And therefore he writes, if you have somebody who is in a state of avelus, yud beis chodesh, because of the loss of a relative, he says, perhaps they don't have to wear a kittel on the night of the Seder because it's just not relevant to them. The whole purpose of the kittel is really to remind us that life is a serious kind of experience. And therefore he says, somebody who is going through avelus perhaps doesn't have to wear it. So this is a big question, whether or not that, in fact, is the reason. A number of years ago, I thought of my own reason. Now, everybody has the right to accept it or not accept it. I learned as a child that, you know, if you find a halacha where there are 10 reasons that are given, it means you also have the right to add your own reason, because nobody's really sure what the real reason is. So I took the liberty, and I feel it's something that's meaningful to me. And everybody has the right to tune out if you're not interested in my suggestion. But I think it's something at least to consider for the night of the Seder. And that is based on a comment made in the Medrash Tanchuma. The Medrash writes in Parshas Chayisara, very striking discussion that the Medrash has. We're not going to read it inside only because it's a long story, but the Medrash says, Avraham Avinu goes through so much in his life, and then finally he goes to the Akedah, and he comes back to hear the horrible news that his wife of so many years has passed away. And he goes and he starts negotiating with Ephron. He wants to buy the Ma'aris HaMachpelah. He wants to bury his wife. He pays an exorbitant amount of money to bury her, even though the land belonged to him. And he goes through this whole ordeal, and he finally buries his wife. The Medrash says on that occasion that God makes a conversation with Avraham Avinu that's very unusual, in my opinion. So the Medrash says that God says to him, Torah, Tchilasa Gemilas Chasadim, V'sofa Gemilas Chasadim. God tells him, you know, I'm all about chesed. I'm all about kindness. I'm all about compassion. After all, when Adam and Chava were created, I, says God, was the one who went and created Chava, and I gave her 24 pieces of jewelry in order that she should look beautiful for her husband, and I walked her down the aisle, and I put her in front of Adam, and I said that they should love each other, and I did all of that. Look what chesed. And in the end of the Torah, we're told that when Moshe Rabbeinu passes away, God, so to speak, goes out of his way, and he's the only one who's involved in burying Moshe Rabbeinu, so God says, I'm all about chesed, this is what I do. He looks at Avraham Avinu, and he says, look at you. Wow, you're willing to invest so much money and so much energy and so much time to bury your wife? What a bal chesed. Amazing. Shali haisa hamida hazos. This was my way of life. This is what I thought I was the one who was providing the world with chesed, with compassion, and with love. And now I see that you're such a caring person. What a gentleman. Amazing. And therefore God says, as a reward for the wonderful acts of kindness that you did for your wife Sarah by burying her, I'm going to give you a special gift. What is that special gift? I'm going to give you a white coat, says the Medrash. From the best of my knowledge, that is the first kittel in history. I think so. Avraham Avinu gets it as a gift from God himself. Now when you think about that story, I think there's something that's very unusual about the story. Here you have Avraham Avinu, whose entire life was dedicated, was solely focused to an unwavering commitment to chesed. And his tent was always open, and he's inviting people into his home, and he's feeding them, and he's giving them everything, and he's there for everybody, and he's teaching them, and him and his wife are doing everything. So you wake up at the end of his life, when he does something that I believe any normal husband would have done, goes out of his way to bury his wife. I don't think it's called going out of your way, it's called being a normal person. That's what you do. That's what anybody would do. So now God appears to him and he says, wow, what a bal chesed, what an amazing person. Your kindness is just incredible. I'm overwhelmed. And because you're such a kind gentleman, therefore, I'm going to give you this wonderful gift of a white coat. Does this make sense? God never appeared to him until this point. God never had this discussion with him. With all the chesed he was doing his entire life, all of a sudden God shows up to him and God tells him, you know, I'm overwhelmed by your kindness. I'm amazed. And I think the answer is, based on a comment I once saw by one of the great Talmidim of the Arizal, Rab Chaim Vital writes the following. Listen carefully, I forgot to put it on here. Yeshnam b'nei Adam, he says, this is not in the context of Avraham Avinu, it has nothing to do with Pesach, but he writes the following. Yeshnam b'nei Adam, there are people asher meitivim im zulasam. There are people who go around throughout life and they are there helping everybody. The Hatzalah member, the Chevra Kadisha, you're on the Chesed committee, you're going Bikur Cholim, you know, Camp Simcha, everything. You're doing all the acts of kindness, everything one can ever do. You're going, amazing. It's great. And you know, this is so profound for me because I think about it all the time. I'm in a position, when I was in Smicha in NYU, Rabbi Penner told us the following and it made a big impression on me. He said, you know what's amazing about the Rabbanus? He said, you're in a candy store of Chesed. He said, every moment of your life, you're able to do a chesed for somebody. There's somebody who wants something from you. And it's amazing. He said, you can go through your entire life being in a candy store of chesed. He said, in his opinion, that was the greatest mark of what the rabbinate is. Made a big impression on me. But at the same time, it's so beautiful. But, writes Reb Chaim Vital, you're running around and doing chesed for everyone. And you're making sure that your entire day is filled with helping people and doing things of acts of kindness and charity, ulam. However, he says, very often you'll find, im nishoseyem uvene besam enam meitivim. Do those individuals, myself included, you can run around and do everything for everybody, but when it's bedtime at home, are you there to help your spouse? When your children need you, how much chesed are you willing to do for your own family? So it's very nice to run around and to be in the newspapers and everybody's going to see all the wonderful things that you're involved in and the guest of honors and it's all great and it's wonderful and you're helping people and you're helping institutions. But what about with your own family? Writes from Chaim Vital. V'sochkim liyom achron lemar. And they say to themselves, I'm okay. B'bo'am lebezen shamala. When I get upstairs and God starts to have a conversation with me, yiftuchu lahem shari gan eden. God is going to open the gates. Why? He's going to say, look how many people you've helped, look how many marriages you've saved, and look how many sick patients you visited in the hospital, and look how many wonderful simchas you attended. You made people so happy, and it's wonderful, and it's great. However, he says, Avol, in my opinion, writes Reb Chaim Vital, oy lahem ve'oy lenafsham. Boy, do I feel bad for them. Why? Ki lo yedu ve'lo yavinu, because these people have no understanding, they don't know. Shekol maseh ha-chesed shalahem hevel ur'us ruach. They don't know that all the chesed that they were busy with their entire lives is worthless. It's meaningless. God has no interest in any of it. Because if you can't figure out that Barosh HaBarishona yesh la'adam lasos chesed im ishto ubanav uvnei beso, if you cannot understand and appreciate that the most profound act of chesed that a person needs to be involved in is with their own family, with those who are closest to them, to talk respectfully to our spouses, to treat each other in a way that is kind, that is compassionate, to have patience for each other, writes from Chaim Vital, everything else that we do is worthless in the eyes of God. He's not interested. And unfortunately, we see so many people who get caught up with this. Sometimes I'm amazed. You look at people who the community holds up on such a pedestal, but I get to see them at a very personal level, and you see the way they interact with their spouses, and it's embarrassing. And it's embarrassing because that's not what a Baal Chesed is all about. If you can't first figure out how to be respectful with each other, then you don't belong being in a position of helping other people either. Based on that, I feel this is perhaps what God was impressed with Avraham Avinu. You spent your whole life being there for everybody. You spent your whole life opening your home and feeding everyone and teaching them. And every moment of your life was there for the entire world. God says, let me see, the test to know whether or not all of what you did throughout life was actually worthwhile, the test that I will see whether or not you truly are a benevolent and kind person, whether or not you really meant all of this for altruistic reasons, is when it comes time to bury your wife, to do that most mundane act that any husband is supposed to do, that any family member is supposed to give dignity, let's see if you're willing to go above and beyond for your wife also. And only after seeing that, God says, that teaches me that everything that you've done in your life until this point also was sincere and also was real. And on that occasion, God gives him the gift of the white coat. You know, Pesach, as we know, I don't have to tell any of you, it's a stressful time, and there's a lot of tension, and there's a lot of pressure, and people get irritated, and there's so much preparation. It doesn't only mean women prepare. There are children who prepare in our home, and everybody's doing their thing, and everybody's preoccupied and absorbed with trying to make sure that Pesach is going to be what they want it to do. I believe, perhaps on the night of the Seder, we put on that white coat before the meal begins to remind ourselves of the first white coat in history. That before we do anything else, let's make sure that we give time to give appreciation and to express our gratitude to those who we are closest with. Let us make sure that with all the things we've been busy with, let us take out time to also highlight and to concentrate and focus on those who are sitting around the table and what they have contributed to make this Yom Tov meaningful. Perhaps that is another reason. The same way Avraham Avinu, the first white coat in history, got it only when he showed his appreciation for his spouse, when he showed his appreciation for his own family. Perhaps that is another added level of meaning to why it is that we have the opportunity to wear a white garment on the night of the Seder. And yes, men need the reminder more than women. Perhaps that is why they wear it. I think it's an insight to consider. I know I should be saying this to the men, and I will, don't worry. But I think it's at least a thought to consider, because the night of the Seder, as we know, is supposed to be a festive, a celebratory time, and unfortunately so often, because of the buildup that we have getting to the Yom Tov and all the stress that we go through to do it properly, we don't have the opportunity to sit back and actually enjoy the night of the Seder, which is a very critical component. How many matzahs are we supposed to have on the night of the Seder? That is a good question. As we know, on every Yom Tov, we have an obligation to eat Lechem Mishneh. You're supposed to have a double portion to remind us of the double portion of the month. Well, on the night of the Seder, the Gemara tells us that we're supposed to eat Lechem Oni, which means a poor man's bread, which means that it's supposed to be broken. So the Rishonim discuss, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that the same way you have two matzahs, two challahs on every regular Shabbos and Yom Tov, so you need to have two full matzahs on the night of the Seder, plus a third which is broken, in order to remind you of the poor man's bread? Or perhaps do we mean that on the night of the Seder, instead of having two regular full matzahs, you can have one full one and one broken one? because that is the way a poor man eats. So this is a major discussion in the Rishonim, and the Shulchan Aruch adopts the opinion of those who believe that you're supposed to have three matzahs on the night of the Seder. Two of them are supposed to be whole, and one of them is supposed to be broken. My father, every year when he makes the Seder, points out to all of us that it doesn't mean that you have to be so territorial to only put three matzahs on the table. Some people think you're only allowed to put three matzahs on the table, and then when it comes time to actually eat the matzah in the middle of the Seder, you're scrambling around trying to find a box and you need more. So my father always taught us that when he made the Seder, this is what he did and this is what he continues to do. We have that like Lucite box that the matzahs fit into. I think it's very nice. So we put like 25 matzahs into that box, or 20 matzahs into the box. And by Yachatz, my father breaks like 10 of them. So you have all the matzah there, and then when it comes time for everybody to eat matzah, it's all on the table already. Everything's ready. When we say you need three matzahs, it doesn't mean only three matzahs. It means you have to have a minimum of three. So that is with regard to the matzah on the table. We know that we have an obligation for everybody, both men and women equally, to drink the four cups of wine on the night of the Seder. And as we said, you cannot just drink four cups in a row. The four cups are meant to be a meaningful part of the Seder. So the first cup is supposed to be for Kiddush, and the second cup is supposed to be while we recount the story of the Haggadah, while we talk about the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The third cup is supposed to be while we bench, and the fourth cup is supposed to be while we recite the Hallel. So the Shulchan Aruch tells us that we're supposed to go out of our way to have wine that we enjoy. You're not supposed to just go into the closet and get rid of the wines that you didn't like from the Shalach Manos you got. You're supposed to think about it in advance and purchase the wines that you are actually going to enjoy. After all, the night of the Seder is supposed to be Zman Cheiruseinu. It's a time of enjoyment. It's a time where we feel majestic, and therefore you're supposed to drink wine that you enjoy. Rashi famously comments, why is it that we have four cups of wine? Rashi says it is based on the Psukim in Parshas Va'era, where we are told, V'hotseisi, V'hitzalti, V'ga'alti, V'lakachti. Very nice, but ask the Mordechai if that is true, that it's based on that Pasuk, just arbitrarily we have four different Lashonos Shel Ge'ula, four different ways of formulating the Ge'ula that the Torah describes for us. So if that's true, ask the Rishonim, why don't you have four matzahs? Why don't you also have four pieces of chicken on the night of the Seder? And why don't you also have four chairs that you sit on and four pillows that you use? Why do we only have four cups of wine? What's the significance of the wine per se that we only have to have four cups of wine and not four anything else? Writes of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach such a beautiful insight, and he suggests the following. What the Torah means to say, V'hotseisi, V'hitzalti, V'ga'alti, V'lakachti, means that the liberation from Mitzrayim did not happen in one moment. It was a process. It went in stages. There were different chapters of our freedom. So first, we had the opportunity to stop working, but we were still living in the country. And then after that, each stage, each chapter of our freedom came one after the other. It built on the next. Writes from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as it continued to grow, as our freedom continued to highlight itself, it became more profound of a feeling for us. We felt more free with each sense of freedom that we got, with each shlav, with each chapter of the redemption. And therefore, writes from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the Chachamim were trying to figure out, what can we instruct people to do on the night of the Seder that will make them feel a more intensified, a more magnified sense of enjoyment as the evening goes on? He says, if we're going to tell you to eat one matzah, and then a second matzah, and a third matzah, and a fourth matzah, nobody's going to enjoy that. That is not going to make you happier as the evening goes on. Wine is the only item that we drink that the more we have, the more we enjoy it. And therefore, he writes, this is, in particular, the item that is chosen that we have four, because this really reminds us of the different stages, the chapters of redemption. And as we go on the evening, it becomes more and more exciting, it becomes more and more enhanced and intensified that we are free people, and therefore he says this is why it is limited only to the wine, and we don't have the minhag to have four matzahs or to sit on four chairs or to have four pillows, because none of that would help us garner that sense of freedom that is going to be expressed by having the wine throughout the night of the Seder. The last thing we'll talk about very briefly, we have 1 minute left, is the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. As we know, the primary mitzvah of the evening is we have an obligation to talk and to discuss all of the stories and to recount everything that happened in the days of Mitzrayim. I get this question every year from rabbis all over the world who say, what was it like growing up in the home of Rav Schechter? What did he talk about on the night of the Seder? And I can tell you, my father treated us like any other father would, and he didn't have any gematrias, he didn't have anything fancy to say at the night of the Seder. He taught us like children are supposed to be taught. He sat there every year telling us the same things about different points along the way throughout the Seder of Emuna and how the Ribbono Shel Olam loves us, and pointing out that throughout the story of the Haggadah that God took us out of Mitzrayim, and he just explained the story the way it's supposed to be explained, without anything fancy, and that's the way it's really supposed to be done. The Rambam tells us this, is what the Rama writes as well. The Rama says, if you look at number Zion, that even if it means that you have to say the Haggadah in English or in Yiddish or in some other language that you feel your family will better appreciate or understand, that is what should be done. So although it's nice and it's important for us to say the words of the Haggadah, more importantly, we have to make sure that we recount all of the stories in a way in which our family will understand it. I was once at a Seder where, this is not what was done. I was at a Seder once where everybody was so focused on making sure they said every word that they were just mumbling along the way to say the words, and there was no real dialogue. And this is a major mistake. That is not what the Seder experience is supposed to be like. The most important thing that we can do is to actually express in dialogue, in discussion with our children, with our grandchildren, with everybody around the table, what exactly the Seder means to us and what exactly the experience of coming out of Mitzrayim, of redemption, is really supposed to mean for the entire Jewish people. And therefore, on the night of the Seder, one has to go out of their way that before the Seder begins, you should try and just flip through the Haggadah without all of the fancy Divrei Torah. I know many shuls have a class in which they go through insights on the Haggadah. It always bothers me because I've been to many of those shiurim, and it never uplifted my Seder in any way. In any way, I'm sorry to say it. I'm not attacking anybody. Everybody can do what they want. Just personally, it never uplifted my experience of the Seder. To go and hear, why did they choose this word to put in the Haggadah instead of that one? It's all wonderful. It's all nice. But the bottom line is that going to make your children appreciate the Seder anymore? Try to go through the Haggadah, which I hope to do next week when we give some insights on the Haggadah, just to go through simply, what lessons can we actually take out of the Haggadah that will uplift, that will actually make the evening meaningful and memorable for our children? Our children are not going to remember the Gematria. It's not interesting to them. It's not exciting. Our children are not going to remember why Ha Lach Ma'anya is in Aramaic instead of Hebrew, and why it's here, and why it's not in the end of the Seder, in the beginning of the Seder. That's not what's going to do it for them. When you have the experience, when you have the opportunity to talk to them and to explain to them and to highlight some of the points of emuna, of hashkacha, of ways that we can really relate to in our generation and in our times, the story that was so many thousands of years ago that continues to be the story of the Jewish people throughout the exile, that is the real way to have the Seder. That is the way that we're supposed to engage them. Like the Rambam says, you have to explain it to them on their level in a way that they will appreciate. I don't think most children appreciate some of the Divrei Torah that are sometimes shared at the Seder. And I think we have to think about that before Pesach comes around. We have to go through the Haggadah and actually try to find some touch points in which we can engage our children in a meaningful way. So, Amir Tashem, next week, we will try to do that.